proceed with this evening's topic, which is the great and awesome figure of Hermes. As you are aware, no doubt, some religions, such as Buddhism and Christianity and Islam, Confucianism, possess human founders whom we can locate in history. Others, like Taoism, Shinto, and Hinduism, grew from early, probably shamanistic beginnings to their later condition of great development and of sublime grandeur. Two religions, however, represent an exception to both of these categories, and they are Gnosticism, religion to which I and various others in this place are attached, the Gnostic tradition, and its very close, indeed perhaps its very closest representative, Hermeticism. There was no special person who founded Gnosticism, although the majority of the Gnostic teachers, as we know, came to attach themselves to the then brand new movement of Christianity. And most Gnostic scriptures make repeated reverential references to Jesus. In fact, we are now at the point in scholarship wherein most of the normative currently published literature, when such terms appear as pagan Gnosticism, they almost inevitably refer to Hermeticism. Gnosticism proper is now quite clearly recognized as a Christian or at least Christian-related phenomenon. Similarly, there was no man by the name of Hermes who founded what often was translated as the religion of the mind, or as it became known, Hermeticism. The origins of the Hermetic teachings are lost, and they are lost in the land of myth and legend, which, however, did not stop the Hermetic teachers from attaching their system to the name and the figure of Hermes. Hermes, of course, was the Greek god of the mind, or as probably today we would call it, consciousness. And so it may be called a god, or perhaps even the god of wisdom. We will say more about the Greek Hermes in a few minutes. Hermes, of course, is also known for possessing as far as his representation is concerned in statues and images, as possessing wings on his sandals and wings on his helmet to indicate that he flies about. And so it's probably appropriate that a kind of noisy new hermetic device called a helicopter should be circling around at this particular time. However, we do express the merciful hope that it will not continue to do so indefinitely. We will say more about the particular Greek Hermes, but any writings within a particular time and within a certain cultural milieu that were held to be inspired by true divine wisdom were attributed generally to the god of wisdom, and they were very often said to be written by Hermes himself. That is why we possess a quite extensive and very beautiful literature. Some excerpts will be shared with you later on, which are called the Hermetic Writings, and which are poetically, mythically attributed to Hermes. Now, we need to remember that these were times where, let's say, personal ambition and vainglory were considered to be incompatible with spiritual, with religious pursuits, and where people, in all humility, but also in all honesty, were able to say that when they wrote down something that was inspired by a higher source of wisdom, this was written by Hermes. Later on, when kind of a much more personalistic mindset came to prevail, such as in medieval Christianity, this poetic license of authorship was taken literally. And so when we find various medieval chronicles, we often see represented there as a historical person, Hermes the Thrice Great, or Hermes Trismegistos, greatest of kings, greatest of philosophers, and greatest of priests. But this was a turning of an archetypal myth into history, which of course has been the bane of Christendom after the 3rd or the 4th century, and which is still very much with us. So we have to understand that. These were the very direct kind of unsophisticated results of a shifting of gears from a largely ahistorical, archetypal and mythological worldview to the linear, concrete historical worldview, which eventually came to prevail. It didn't really obtain, I would say, final victory since until a good period after the Renaissance, but it kept encroaching upon things. And that is why there is that kind of confusion about Hermes as a historical figure, or Hermes as the really the god, the archetype that inspired works of wisdom. We find that sort of thing in other sources. You find it, for instance, in the early Kabbalistic works, such as the Zohar, which where most of the teachings are attributed to a legendary Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, who, however, if he ever lived, had very little connection with it. Right down to, say, our good friend Dr. Carl Jung, who, as again many of you know, wrote a very beautiful little Gnostic treatise called The Seven Sermons to the Dead, which again he poetically attributed to the Gnostic teacher Basilides, while obviously he wrote it himself. So this sort of thing went on. Thus we must understand then that the various writings which are our principal sources today about the religion, the mystery of the Hermeticists, the Hermetica, the Hermetic writings, are in a modern sense really anonymous. But we must also be cognizant of the possibility that they were all inspired by a common mysterious spiritual principle, which in today's language might be described as an archetype, and to which the name Hermes was given. Now, another important matter that we have to recognize, very, very important from this point of view, is that the Hermes appearing in the literature of Hermeticism, in the Hermetic books, is not the Greek Hermes pure and simple. The name is there. Rather, it is quite certain that this figure is, to a major extent, the wisdom god of ancient Egypt, Thoth or Tahuti, who has, of course, been one of the great gods of ancient Egypt from early pharaonic times on. As long as 5,000 years ago there existed already in Hermopolis, as it came to be called later on, the city of Hermes, or Khmun, there existed a great center of worship dedicated to this great figure. So he's been there for a very long time. He played part in the creation myth of pharaonic Egypt. He was also the keeper and author of the records of the gods, the scribe. And also, most importantly for our purposes, a psychopomp, a guide of the souls in the underworld. He was regarded as the author of all writing, and the actual scribe who wrote the ancient scriptures. He supervised the drawing up of the laws and saw to it that these and other holy books would be preserved in appropriate libraries. He was known as the Lord of the Moon, who was in charge of the mysterious and dark world of the night. And more than this, he was really himself the divine word from which all the manifest worlds arose. There is good reason to suspect that the Logos concept, enunciated by the Jewish philosopher Philo of Alexandria and utilized by Christianity, may have at least in part been derived also from the Egyptian god of wisdom. So that in a sense, at least in that part of the world, he really was the first Logos, the first word incarnate. In the myth of Osiris and Isis, as we explained in our first discussion about Osiris, he was the master magician who taught Isis how to bring her slain royal spouse back to life and thus conceive the conquering victorious hero Horus. The later story of the Osiris myth includes in the pyramid texts primarily the tremendously lengthy story of the ongoing incredible warfare wherein Horus fights his evil uncle Seth and eventually conquers and wins the battles. And in these battles there are frequent engagements where the heroes, the leading heroes and others become wounded when the armies are exhausted and the battle wouldn't go on. And what always happens then is Hermes appears. And like a sort of primordial Dr. Henry Kissinger, he runs back and forth between the armies, but not for the purpose of really telling them at that point to make peace, but rather to help to bandage up and heal the wounded and give each side new courage to go at it again. And only when you might say the entire process has been completed, when the time is ripe to make peace, then he becomes the ambassador of both sides negotiating the final great peace of Upper and Lower Egypt. In all of these features, we could really go on and on, there are extremely important esoteric overtones which become part of Hermeticism and of the Hermetic traditions throughout the ages. Because the aeonial battles between Horus and Seth are, believe it or not, the prototype for alchemy. This is the conflict of the two opposing powers. And Hermes is the alchemist, the facilitator. Also the alchemical Mercury, since Mercurius is the Roman name for Hermes. And so he is the facilitator of the reconciliation of the opposites. But the reconciliation of the opposites occurs only at the culmination of the process of the conflict when the time is ripe for such reconciliation. A premature reconciliation of the opposites leads to further trouble. Let's say the kind of peace treaties that are enforced from above on people who have no inclination, at least for that particular arrangement, are the root and cause of further difficulties, as I would think by now we have fairly well discovered in the history of our culture and others also, except for the fact, of course, that nobody knows any history, nobody wants to know any history, they don't teach it in the schools, and the memory of the majority of our people in this country barely reaches back to the Vietnam War, which is, of course, a great calamity. Because out of that kind of ignorance only further difficulties can arise. Why do you suppose there is all of this hullabaloo going on now in many parts of Europe? Let's see, the Croatians and the Serbs having a go at it, and others too. Well, that's all the result of a certain peace treaties which were enforced on these various countries after World War I, certainly farther back than one can expect anybody to remember. After all, I was talking to very prosperous, very rich person, lady, sometime back here. Maybe in her late 30s or early 40s or somewhere around there, and she asked me perfectly with a straight face and with a straight voice, on whose side did Great Britain fight in World War II? I said, I believe Britain fought on her own side. So I don't think that I have really cleared the difficulty up for her. But these are the kind of peace treaties and arrangements which are enforced on people, as after World War I at Versailles and other places. And they are premature arrangements. Processes have not been allowed to work themselves out whereby a proper arrangement could obtain. And therefore, of course, wait a while, maybe 40 years, maybe 30 years, whatever the case, maybe even a century. And just as soon as certain external restraints are removed, the conflict is right there again. People can't understand that. Well, don't these people love peace? Everybody likes peace as long as it does not interfere with what they would like to do and be. Priorities change, so then difficulties arise. In any event, I don't want to overstress the point, but what all of this means is that in all manner of situations of that kind in life, where there are binaries, opposites engaged with each other, a process must take place. This is again my favorite subject of the principle of process versus an episode. To most people nowadays, life is episodic. It consists of episodes. After all, isn't that the way the television works, and there are episodes, right? And then tune in again. This has become a metaphor for life. Tune in tomorrow, next time, same station, and then there'll be another episode. And of course, the connections are not really recognized, and so we don't see processes, we only see episodes. But Hermes is the governor of the process. And the prototype are the great battles in the pyramid texts where he guards the conflict and shepherds it to the point where the final reconciliation, the proper solution is possible, and then he brings it about. So all of these elements that we mentioned, his association with writing, his association with creation, his association with bringing Osiris back to life, all of these, they all become sort of the root concepts of the function of the archetype of Hermes, the thrice great, as time goes on. Now, of course, there is also the Greek Hermes to consider, who is part of this figure, who was really, as it has been said, I think, by Jane Ellen Harrison, the great mythologist, that Hermes was the most Greek of all the Olympian gods. Interesting how he ended up in Egypt then. Which means that he was the most baffling, the most confusing, the most complex of the gods. And if you ever been around Greeks, you will find that they are baffling and confusing and complex people. The name Hermes is derived from Herma or Hermaion, which is a pile of stones. The reason for that is that in the myth concerning Hermes, he killed the many-eyed guardian monster Argus and was brought to trial for this by his fellow gods. And the gods voted with stone pebbles, sort of like blackballing somebody, blackstoning somebody. They voted with stone pebbles, acquitting him. They threw the pebbles at his feet, and saw a heap of stones built around him as all the gods threw down the stones, which meant you are okay, you are exonerated. He is a son of Zeus. Euripides, in the prologue to Ion, makes Hermes introduce himself in the following manner. Atlas, who wears on back of bronze the ancient abode of gods in heaven, had a daughter whose name was Maia, born of a goddess. She lived with Zeus and bore me, Hermes, servant of the immortals. Coincidence or archetypal synchronicity, Buddha's mother was also Maia. At least it's one of her names. And the astrological association in much of Buddhist astrology with the Lord Buddha is the planet Mercury. Mercury being, but again, the Roman name of Hermes. So already as a small child, Hermes is a trickster. He escapes from his cradle and he steals some of Apollo's oxen. At the same time, he took the shell of a turtle and strung strings across the shell and thus invented the instrument called the lyra or the lyre, which is not the appellation for lawyers, lyre, you know, but rather the musical instrument of the poets. And he pacified Apollo by giving him the lyre, and that is how Apollo became the patron of music. And thus Apollo not only forgives him, but he becomes his good friend. Apollo, of course, is a sun god, symbolic of the light of consciousness, perhaps even sort of ego consciousness, Hermes takes the oxen from him, which means, I think the Latin word for oxen in the plural is pecunia. And that's how you come up with something pecuniary, because how many cattle you had, that was the measure of your riches. Those were the days when everybody was a cowboy. He takes material things from him, but compensates him by giving him poetry, imagination. It seems that Apollo is certainly wise enough to recognize that it is a good exchange. So he is really the one in the Greek myth too who introduces art, imagination, and substitutes it for a mere hoarding of material possessions. Perhaps we ought to really erect a temple for Hermes in his Greek form, in our culture. He could do us a great deal of good. And he becomes the master of eloquence, god of roads, of commercial transactions, good luck, of all games including gymnastics, I'm sad to say, but certainly not of jogging and aerobics or uroborics or what are they called nowadays? That's when people twist themselves in a hoop and like the uroboros, you know. He wears that broad hat and wings and the winged sandals and carries the caduceus. Now you can see how the qualities, even after this very brief description, are similar with the Egyptian Thoth. But of course in Egypt everything carries a grave, deep, and sort of eternal image. The Egyptians are the first ones whom one might say in Latin, again, carried full gravitas. While with the Greeks it's always very, well, shall we say, mercurial. But it's definitely the same archetype. And the truly interesting aspect of that situation is that the ancient Greeks knew that. These people had a fabulous sense of being affinitized to archetypes, to archetypal realities. And they came right out and said it, yes, Hermes is Thoth. Just like they said that all the goddesses are Isis. Of course, they looked to the Egyptians as really kind of the elders of their world. But they had that wonderful sense of recognizing one archetype in several archetypal images and giving recognition to that underlying reality, that underlying unity, which of course is a quality that wasn't totally lost for a long time. That's where the alchemists could say that the alchemical mercury, which is both the spirit of Mercury, the chemical, and the Mercurius Hermes figure, was the same as Christ. So once again, a rationalist could never say that. A rationalist would say it's either this or that, you know. But somebody who is affinitized to archetypal realities can say, oh yes, what it really means to say is fulfills the same rule. Archetype is as archetype does. And if he is a reconciler of the opposites, if he redeems the light from the darkness, the lumen naturae, and brings it out into manifestation, then call it Christ, call it Mercury, it is a savior, it is a messiah, it is a reconciler of the opposites, it's a hermetic figure. And so the awesome god image of the Egyptians, conjoined with the swift image of the Greeks, really became the late Greco-Egyptian Hermes at the period of the Alexandrian culture. In the Alexandrian period, when after the conquest of the initial conquest of Egypt on the part of Alexander the Great, and later on the part of the Romans, Alexandria and the surrounding countryside in Egypt became in many ways the spiritual, cultural capital and matrix of the Mediterranean world, and where now there reigned, among others, a figure called by the Greek name of Hermes, because the language by then was Greek for the educated people and Coptic for the less educated, which however was also written in the Greek alphabet and was full of Greek words, bearing the Greek name of Hermes, but having also very largely the characteristics of the Egyptian Thoth. This is the Hermes we are dealing with. We might now say, well, why are we concerning ourselves with this figure? And here I would sort of sound a theory to the effect, I have mentioned this before, and I think it's a fairly good one, that the period a couple of hundred years B.C. and again 100 and 150, 200 years A.D. was a messianic period for a large portion of the Mediterranean area. An archetypal situation arose wherein we might say the archetype of redemption became of extremely great importance. And it manifested in the Semitic milieu, but it also manifested in Egypt and elsewhere. It's well known that the Jews were not the only people who were expecting a Messiah, a sort of a Messiah, right at the time of Jesus. Well, you know, they didn't call it by the Hebrew name of Messiah, of course, but that is what it was. Even if we go back a bit further on, we extend it to about 500 or so B.C., Alexander the Great and his partial successors, such as the Ptolemaic rulers, the Ptolemaic pharaohs of Egypt, were also redeemers. One of the greatest Ptolemaic kings of Egypt was named Ptolemaeus Soter. Soter was the most solemn name later on attributed to Christ. A reality, a spiritual reality for a few hundred years was moving and brewing and trying to come into manifest existence with as great a power and clarity as possible, and various people interpreted it in a variety of ways. Of course, the Jews interpreted it to a large extent within their own tradition and with their own socio-political milieu of the time. Here's somebody who is going to come and redeem us from the bloody Romans. Very much as if you had asked people recently anywhere in Russia or in Eastern and Central Europe, if a Redeemer came right now, if Christ came back to Earth again, what do you think he would do? They would have said, he would drive out the damn Russians. He would drive out the Soviets, you know. Well, that's how the Jews felt about the Romans at that particular time. And who says that perhaps that's not what has happened, actually? You know, you might give that a little bit of thought, too. There could be forces just a little bit deeper at work than the politicians of this world. But we wouldn't want to beat around the bush too much about that. That is what was taking place, and it found various manifestations. And as in the Semitic milieu, it came to constellate itself eventually with tremendous power around Jesus. In the Egyptian milieu, it came to constellate itself around the figure, no longer an embodied individual, perhaps never was, around the figure of Hermes. And so two parallel developments arose. One arose, at least initially, in Palestine, in Judea, and that was Christian Gnosticism, and the other phenomenon arose in Egypt as Hermeticism. But the curious thing is that their content, their thrust, their message was virtually identical. There are no two movements that are closer together than those two. We find, for instance, if we try to look at these in a manner which is always to a certain extent helpful within what has happened in the sociological context, we find, for instance, in that very fine turn of the century or early part of this century work, the thrice greatest Hermes by a man whom I very much respect, G.R.S. Mead. We find it in the first volume of his work, where he presents on the basis of the various historians, he presents a graphic account of the tremendous religious enthusiasm and the kind of messianic inventive enterprise of the Hellenistic age, and he demonstrates how great a role the figure of the Greco-Egyptian Hermes played in the spiritual movements active within this period indicated, Hermeticism and Gnosticism, the two movements. Now, once again, let me indicate that the two had much more in common than many writers assumed. and that is becoming increasingly clear now. The principal difference really was only that the Hermeticist utilized the figure of Hermes as the archetype of salvific wisdom, while the latter, the Gnostics, accepted the recently arisen messianic figure of Jesus in a similar matter, in similar manner. Both Hermeticists and Gnostics used the term Gnosis to describe the experience of liberating interior knowledge. Both regarded the physical world or cosmos as a place of confinement from whence Gnosis can liberate the human spirit. The affinity existing between the two schools is also borne out by the fact that in the now increasingly famous Nag Hammadi library of the Egyptian Gnostics, several works of purely Hermetic character were found. It is very likely that Christian Gnostics and so-called pagan Hermeticists freely availed themselves of each other's literature and derived benefits therefrom. It is quite likely that the Hermetic communities were primarily Egyptian men and women, who, having been brought up in the immemorial traditions of their land, preferred an Egyptian archetypal structure to the Semitic one of Christian Gnosticism or of Jewish Essenism, or even the Greek orientation of the Neoplatonic and Neopythagorean mysticism. Like the Gnostics, these devotees of Hermes were people who, as Jung said about the Gnostics, worked with original, compelling forces and images, if you want to put it psychologically, of the deep unconscious. They were individuals who experienced deep realizations and communed with powerful images in states of ecstasy and of visionary transport. Their writings, as any reader can easily recognize, are full of beauty and poetic rhythm. They are replete with intense feeling generated by profound individual experiences. Gnostics and Hermeticists both really based their lives and work on the position that, and this is very important, this is the cornerstone. Without that, there is no Hermetic and no Gnostic point of view. Namely, that intimate, first-hand, and personal knowledge of divine things is possible for human beings. Indeed, it may be said that they held that unless a human being enters into an intimate relationship with the divine, that person is lacking in anything that could be called true fulfillment. And so all of the Hermetic practices, the Hermetic teachings, were organized in such a fashion that they would lead toward that kind of an objective. The Gnostic and the Hermetic systems are really all in the nature of circumambulating the center. Circumambulating the center after the fashion of a spiral and coming closer and closer to it. At least it is my view, I'm much more familiar with the Gnostic writings than I am with the Hermetic, but I know that in the Gnostic writings that I have been exposed to, I feel there is really no extraneous material at all. Everything that is there is designed to somehow lead the individual closer and closer to the experience of Gnosis. It is all organized around that Gnosis. There is very little window dressing. There is very little garnishing. It all has to do with that. And of course, the principal reason for that being that as far as the evidence indicates, these scriptures were written by people who themselves have experienced and who therefore could phrase things in such a manner that everything would lead the reader, the hearer, in whatever way it is communicated, to the experience again. This is, of course, the principle that when the blind lead the blind, they both end up in the hole or in the ditch. And this is what is happening in the world. In many ways, this is what has been happening for the world for a long time. When the people who teach, when the people who decree dogmas, when the people who lead countries, religions, societal groups, whatever they may be, themselves have not experienced what they are talking about. They don't have, they obviously don't have, can't have the ability to lead others to the experience. However, when the Urerfahrung, as old Jung would have has called it in German, the source experience, the original experience, is still reasonably near, when it's only one or two or three people removed, there is still some energy of it filtering down. If you go to the Carmelite monks some years after St. John of the Cross or St. Teresa of Avila were there, some of the experience of these great mystics will still linger on there. That is why the saints, the mystics, the experiencers, have really been the salt of the earth who kept things moving, because they brought some of that experience back in again. Another shot in the arm. Aha, it can be done. These people have actually been there. They've experienced, they knew. You don't just have to believe. You actually can go there. They have done it. They have done it. Well, maybe it can happen to us again. This sort of thing is a terrific boon. But, you know, later on, in come the rationalists. And they say, well, this all can be figured out. We don't need all of this stuff. It's a matter of neat categories. It's a matter of reason and work on that basis. Well, of course, then, these are the people who, to use the biblical adage, referring to the Pharisees, who were that kind of a bunch, you know, they sit in the door like nasty old dogs. They sit in the door and growl at everybody who comes to the door and won't let people come in, and they themselves will not go in either. So they are literally the dogs in the manger, or the dogs at the door of the manger, who will keep everyone out, and then they don't go in either. That is always a terribly awful and difficult thing. But these were the people who were very close to these things and who worked with these images. And as I mentioned before, we possess no names of writers and teachers of the Hermetic works. But because that was not their method, they would not sign their name to things. We know of no Hermetic master, for instance, to be compared with the Gnostic masters. We know at least of a lot of the great Gnostic teachers, we have their names, Valentinus, Basilides, Carpocrates, others. But this should not lead us to believe, however, that great teachers and initiators did not exist in Hermetic communities. They certainly did exist. One of the most fascinating treatises to come to light in more recent times within the context of the Nag Hammadi materials, for instance, is the book The Eight Reveals the Ninth, or The Treatise of the Eight and the Ninth, which describes the spiritual experiences of a Hermetic teacher who is referred to as father and of a student called son. And it gives us a charming picture of the spiritual relationship as it apparently existed between master and disciple in the Hermetic community. In fact, it would appear from the available evidence that what would happen is that there were these initiators, Hermetic teachers, who became, for the time being, for the experience, the... So they were the psychopomp in a physical body. And they would lead the initiate through into the heavens, into the deeper experiences. And it is that kind of a dialogue between the guide and the person who is now given to experience all of these that we find in the Hermetic works. Well, let me just get hold of a few examples of this to give you an idea as to what kind of material we are dealing with here. Especially if I find it, yes, here we are. Let me read to you at this point a few prayers from the Hermetic Corpus that are addressed to Hermes to give us a feeling of the attitude and the spirit of these people and how they approached Hermes. Here is an invocation to Hermes. Come unto me, Lord Hermes, even as into women's wombs come babes. And what an interesting metaphor, you know. I want to become pregnant with the God. Come into me so that I can give birth to you. Come unto me, Lord Hermes, who dost collect the foods of gods and men. Lord Hermes, come to me and give me grace and victory and health and happiness and cheerful countenance, beauty and powers in sight of all. I know thy name that shineth forth in heaven. I know thy forms as well. I know thy tree. I know thy wood as well. I know thee, Hermes, who thou art, and whence thou art, and what thy city is. I know thy names in the Egyptian tongue, and thy true name as it is written on the holy tablet in the holy place at Hermes' city, where thou dost have thy place. I know thee, Hermes, and thou knowest me. I am thou, and thou art I. Come unto me, fulfill all that I crave. Be favorable to me together with good fortune and the blessing of the good. I mean, these are invocations. You know, these are magical formulae whereby Hermes is called. Here is another one. Come unto me, Lord Hermes, O thou of many names, who knowest the secrets hidden both beneath the poles of heaven and underneath the earth. Come unto me, Lord Hermes, thou benefactor, who doest good to all the world. Give ear to me and give me grace with all that are on earth. Open for me the hands of all that give like thee, and make them give me what their hands contain. Even as Horus, if ever he called on thee, O greatest of all gods, in every trial, in every space, against gods and men and demons and things that live in the water and on earth, had grace and riches with gods and men and every living thing beneath the earth, so let me too call on thee. So give me grace, form, and beauty. Hear me, O Hermes, doer of good deeds, thou the inventor of all incantations, speak to me good words. Hear me, O Hermes, for I have done all things that I should do. O soften all towards me and give me might and form, and let them give me what I need. Preserve me evermore for the eternity from all evil, from spells, deceits, and witchery of every kind, from evil tongues, from every check and every enmity of gods and men. Give unto me grace, victory, and satisfaction. For thou art I, and I am thou. Thy name is mine, and mine is thine. For that I am thy likeness. And so forth and so on. There is another very beautiful one here in the beginning. Let me just give you a little bit of that. Another invocation to Hermes as the good consciousness, the good mind. Come unto me, O thou of the four winds, Almighty One, who breathed the spirit into men to give them life, whose name is hidden and beyond the power of men to speak. No prophet even can truly pronounce it. Yes, even the spirits, when they hear thy name, are fearful. O thou whose tireless eyes are sun and moon, eyes that shine in the pupils of the eyes of men. O thou who hast the heaven for head, ether for body, and earth for feet, and for the water round thee oceans deep. Thou the great daemon art, who art the sire of all things good, and nurse of the whole world, thy everlasting reveling place is set above. Thine good emanations of the stars, those diamonds, fortunes, and those fates by whom are given wealth, good blend and good children, good fortune and good death. For thou art the Lord of life, thou art King of heavens and earth and all that dwell therein. And here again the formula comes up again, for thou art I and I am thou. Whatever I speak, may it forever be. For that I have thy name to guard me in my heart. The text which we possess and which have come down to us, the Corpus Hermeticum, the body of Hermetic writings, the work of Stobius, a 6th century scholar who prepared a kind of anthology, and the perfect sermon, or Asclepius. The story has it that there were 42 books of Hermes. One of the titles given to Hermes and embodied in the book is Poimander, which means the shepherd man. This is really the Egyptian form of the good shepherd. The guardian and the facilitator of consciousness. And what is meant by this figure, as far as we are able to discern in the Hermetic writings, is that that the mind is like a flock of sheep. Not a very nice analogy for those who are acquainted with sheep. I have always felt that, at least this is, I like it better as the good shepherd than when it becomes the Lamb of God. Because at least the good shepherd is human and guards all these stupid sheep. When you associate the divine with the Lamb of God, that is really somewhat of a sacrilege. It's really the stupidest animal on God's earth, you know. And all you have to do is go to a place like New Zealand and go around for a while, and it has a most deleterious effect on the people who live there. There is a certain sheepishness that arises and that continues. You fly over the countryside and see these kind of dirty white movements down below, as these walking locusts slowly move and devour everything in front of them. But the mind, say the Hermetic writings, is like a flock of sheep. It is unruly, it scatters easily, and it is imperiled easily. There is a need for a central shepherd who keeps these together. And Hermes, the Hierophant, is the shepherd of the psyche, who keeps the psyche together. And so he is called also the psychopompos, the guide of the soul. Here is a very nice little text about that you will like. This is from the Corpus Hermeticum, and you will see it's clearly an indication of the primal vision of a hermetic devotee. Once having begun to think about existent things, and my mind having eagerly soared to a great height, while my bodily senses were held back, just as in those who are heavy with sleep. is describing an altered state of consciousness. I seem to meet a vast and infinitely great being who called me by name and asked me, what would you hear and see and learn and know by your understanding? I said, who art thou? And he replied, I am Poimandres, that is the shepherd man, the man shepherd. I am the supreme mind, supreme consciousness. I answered him, I desire to learn the things that are and to understand their nature and to know God. About these things, said I long to hear. He spoke to me again. I know what you desire, for indeed I am with you everywhere. Hold in your mind whatever you would learn, and I will teach you. As soon as he had said this, immediately everything changed in aspect before me, and was opened out in a flash. And I saw a boundless vision, and all became light, soft, and joyous, and I loved it at sight. But after a while, a terrible and gloomy darkness had come settling down in one part, twisting in coils like a serpent. Then I saw the darkness change into a sort of moistness, tossed about unspeakably, and pouring out smoke as from a fire. And I heard it giving out an indescribable sound of wailing, for an inarticulate cry was sent out of it. But out of the light came forth a holy word, and stood upon the moistness, seeming to me the voice of light. And pure fire sprang forth out of the moistness and up to the heights. Radiant it was, and swift and active. Thereupon air also, being light, followed the fire rising up, so that it seemed to hang down on it. But earth and water stayed apart, so mingled together that the earth could not be seen. Yet they were kept moving by reason of the breath like words stirring over them. Well, what have you got here? You have the description of a vision. You have the description of an altered state of consciousness. And in it, several important elements stand out. We can sort of very briefly analyze them. First of all, there is a precondition. He said, when I came to think about existent things, when I came to think about the things that are, that's when I was led into this. Now, how often do we think of the things that truly are? So here is the initial discrimination. You have to begin to discern what is truly, what truly exists, autentes, one who does things himself. That's what that means. A primary reality, a real being contemplating a real phenomenon. We talked about Buddha on the last occasion, and we said, for instance, that the Buddhist term for what the Hindus came up with originally as karma is dependent origination. Now, you might also say, when you direct your consciousness towards something that, using those terms, that is outside of and above the realm of karma, something that acts out of itself, that is no longer within the process of dependent origination, that primary reality, then you create the precondition for this kind of a vision. So, you know, what is it that you are asked? Are you after things within the process, down here, whatever it is, things within the dependent origination, things that you want to change, or the things that you want to see to come to pass, back and forth, up and down, then Hermes doesn't come to you. So you have to direct your consciousness towards something that is above these things. And when he speaks with Hermes, now Hermes tells him, yes, I know what you want. I am with you everywhere. You see, I have been here all along. And you say, well, if you have been here all along, then how come you haven't done anything for me before? Well, because I was not in the right frame of mind. Because I was not oriented toward the things that Hermes can do something with. There was no real change of consciousness. Once again is the principle, you have to come into his world. He cannot come into yours. How are you going to do that? Well, the main issue is, after all, unlike many other figures, archetypal figures, maybe even unlike the glorious figure of Christ, you see, Hermes was always called Lord of Consciousness, Lord of the Mind. Now, it's obvious what has to be done here. There has to be an altering of your state of mind. You have to be able to function with your mind in a different fashion from the manner in which you have fashioned before. But isn't that precisely what the Calvinist and other kind of repressive stupidity of our culture is constantly trying to inhibit us, stop us from doing? Right down to such stupid things as to why can't a Mormon drink coffee? Well, he can, but he's not. Do you realize that some time ago there was an argument at Brigham Young University in the cafeteria that the cafeteria would be segregated into the coffee-drinking section and the non-coffee-drinking section? Okay? After all, you know, it might harm the good Mormon boys to inhale some of these coffee fumes or whatever. That's how we are getting to. Now, it'll be that way. Pretty soon, I don't know, there will be the chicken-eating section in the restaurant and sprout munching section and so forth, because the notion runs through in all kinds of ways through the culture that anything that might affect the mind, anything that might cause some kind of a change, a little bit of stimulus, a little bit of excitement, a little bit of altering this way or the other, is bad. You are supposed to stay in the great triviality of your everyday consciousness, day and night, and never let it move. That is what is pleasing unto the Jehovah God. You know? Just, why? Because that way you never reach out of your world. So you just sit there and stand there, and you get commandments, you get things to do, and you just keep on doing. If something changed in your mind, even for a little while, even for a half an hour or an hour, my word, you might see through this. You know, you might say, no, to hell with it. You know, I'm not going to do this anymore. Why should I? Gerald Hurd of blessed memory was one to say that you listen, at that time it was mostly radio and things that you listen to these things about the advertisements and so forth, and it takes a change of consciousness, it takes a kind of illumination to get up, and these were his words, to stay up and say, to hell with it, I will not take juicy fruit gum. You know? Well, you know, whether it's juicy fruit gum or whether it's Jehovah, you know, or whether it's all the shibboleths of the culture, it takes a change of consciousness, it takes a change of mind to be able to break out of that. And that is why you have really the great tendencies. All of the Gnostic-oriented spiritual disciplines are ultimately ecstatic in orientation. They all tell you and motivate you in various ways to learn how to stand outside of yourself, outside of the world, outside of the ordinary routine, because that is where you might learn and understand something. If you could learn and understand by being of the same mind all the time, don't you think you would have learned and understood already? Haven't you tried it long enough? Hasn't humanity tried it long enough? If wisdom arose out of sheer stupidity, Shouldn't this world already be tremendously wise? But you see, it has not done so. It couldn't do so. There has to be a substantial and an essential change, an essential movement of mind. And as we already can see in that particular description, there arises the great light. But what kind of vision does he have just in that short paragraph that he has? He really has a vision of the light and of the darkness. So we can see it's a very Gnostic picture, and it runs through all the Hermetic writings, really the awareness of both of these. But there are many others, and our time is very limited, so I don't think I will be able to read too many of these to you. There is another very interesting and very beautiful one. I'll give you a little bit of it, and then we'll comment on it, and we'll go on and finish up. It should be in four. These are all from the Corpus Hermeticum. But mind, which I think is really better translated as consciousness, the father of all, he who is life and light, gave birth to the human. One like himself, with whom he fell in, this is the great discourse of the Corpus Hermeticum of Love. The mind, the father of all consciousness, gave birth to man, to the human, one like himself, with whom he fell in love as being his own child. For he was most beautiful, having the likeness of the father, so naturally the father fell in love with his own form. And he entrusted to him all creation. Then taking his place in the sphere of creation, man observed what his brother had created, and he too willed to create. Then the father gave him leave, having in him the great energy of the highest rulers. And then he goes on. These fell in love with him, and each one gave a share of his own nature. Then, having gained full knowledge of their being and shared in their nature, he willed to break through the circumference of the orbits and to wear down their might. So he looked down through the harmony and showed to the downward tempting nature the beautiful form of God. So the first love is the universal soul, the nous, the true mind, which gives birth to the human. And the divine falls in love with the human. The second is the love affair of the rulers or planets with the human. That is the one I just read. Each having shared in his own nature. And what does he do? What does he do there? They love us, and they each give us a share of their planetary nature. Let's say Mars gives us strength. Venus gives us passion. Mercury gives us quick thinking. Jupiter gives us majesty and benevolence. Saturn gives us lawfulness. The moon gives us mystery. The sun gives us conscious life. The earth gives us senses, and so forth. This all sounds very well and sort of very positive, and that's why the Hermetics are much more optimistic, they say, than the Gnostics. But listen to what he said then after that. He said, then having gained full knowledge of their being and shared in their nature, he willed to break through the circumference of the orbits and to wear down their might. So first you learn, first you know, first you are in this kind of intimate interaction with the powers of this world and of the planets that rule it, and then eventually you tell them, okay, now you no longer run the show, boys. I am running the show now. Sapiens tam dominabitur astris, to use a certain magical motto that somebody is supposed to have used. The wise shall rule over the stars. But you can't just do it by decree. You see, you have to have a relationship with everything. The result of that relationship is that then you learn and understand and overcome. So we have, as Gnostics, those of us who consider themselves such, we have to be we have to be wise and smart about this. Yes, we want to overcome. And of us it has been said, probably even more so than about others, that we shall overcome. but we must overcome the right way. Just to will ourselves out of the maze will not do it. You can stand in that and say, I want to get out of here. You know, you stand in the middle of the maze and you stomp your feet and say, I want out, I want out. Well, I understand that, but how are you going to get out, you know? You are you going to get out by taking one step after the other and walking through it the right way and getting out? I know that's tedious, and we have done a lot of it, and we are tired, and our feet hurt, and who knows, maybe we've done it even life after life. It's a mess. I agree with you, but it still has to be done that way. So there has to be an intelligent understanding of where we are and what is running the show. And then after that, in the same passage, I can't go through it now because we have to quit, there is, let's say, the third love is the love affair of the human with nature. You see, it was the planets, that's the outer nature, the world. And now here, again, we look down from the archetypal level, so to say, and we show nature our consciousness. So there is an interaction with nature, which is in the nature of a love, says the Hermetic principle. But again, a love that is combined with wisdom. There is an interaction with the outer world that brings forth, let's see, new experiences and a new self, and then allows us to overcome that too. But there is always the understanding that the human did not originate here. He didn't come out of nature like a great big overgrown slug having crawled out of the primeval ooze or whatever. He hasn't even, not even a creature of the planets, although it picked up energies of all of these. So being apart from that, it has to play a delicate game that is loving, but at the same time also sovereign and individual and directed toward overcoming. We can learn from each other. The planets can learn from us, and we can learn from the planets. Nature can learn from us, and we can learn from nature. But it's a delicate interaction, a delicate dance that goes on. So certainly the Hermetic was very, very aware of this this delicate relationship. It is true that we don't find so much of it expressed in those terms in the Gnostic scriptures that we know, although frequently they are also there. But we must recognize there we are dealing to a very large extent, at least originally, with a Semitic matrix, with a Hebrew matrix, that had a different relationship with and to the outer world than the Egyptian, the Greco-Egyptian did. But it's a very beautiful notion, a very beautiful concept, which does not reject out of hand, but does not subordinate oneself to this either, but plays that delicate play, wherein as the right relationship is accomplished, one can overcome. So it's incidentally, not to forget such things, that I am convinced, and I'm certainly not the only one, it has come up before, that the word Hiram is a disguise for Hermes. Herm. Yeah. And so there is a great deal of Hermetic initiatory wisdom that has gone into various secret organizations, such as the Freemasonry and others, and there always the key is one comes up against certain initiatory guardians, and they have to let you pass, otherwise you don't get further in the lodge. You don't get, and how do you do that? You don't do it by kicking the guardian away, you know. In fact, they usually have the power. You are blindfolded, various things, old rituals, they hold maybe something at you, you know, or whatever, menace you a bit, one thing or the other. But you have to give the right words, which means you have to have the right relationship to that person. You have to address him the right way. So you address the planets the right way, you address nature the right way, you address all of these guardians the right way, and by addressing them the right way, they will be compelled to withdraw and let you pass. So, two things. On the one hand, don't identify with your surroundings and with your situation to say that I am just a part of it. If you are just a part of the planets, then you know what's going to happen to you? You're going to go round, around, around the merry-go-round forever and ever and ever. And while all of us like to be in orbit now and then, maybe that's not quite the orbit that you want to be in, you know. So you are not part of it. You are not cosmic. You are more than cosmic. You are above the cosmos. Now this may sound arrogant, it may sound inflated and all of that, and maybe it is. But a bit of arrogance, a bit of inflation is sometimes quite nice. Especially when it's based on something that is true. So, you know, don't identify with it. Don't say I'm just a blob within a bigger blob with all the rest of the blob. You know, recognize that you are there as a separate being, but at the same time realize that there is a relationship between yourself and these other factors, and that this relationship has to be conducted in an insightful manner. You see, Hermes always negotiates. Hermes always interacts. There is always an I and thou in Hermes, although I doubt it that old Jehovah like Martin Buber was very aware of that. You know, he wrote a book called I and Thou. But it is the overcoming of limitations by learning the right relationships with everything. Very tricky, very difficult, needs a lot of intuition, needs a lot of insight, and sometimes also quite a bit of a knowledge of detail. And that is why now I sort of have to stop on that note and just throw in a few things of what happened later on. Hermeticism suffered a somewhat different fate from Gnosticism. Because while both sort of went underground to a certain extent, the Hermetic wisdom never went quite as deep underground as the Gnostic. And it was unearthed rather easily, and the Christians, even Christians who were very afraid of and very hostile to Gnostics, still managed to deal with Hermeticists and Hermetic materials. Hermes was regarded as a sort of an honorary saint of the Christian church for a long time. In fact, alchemical, magical, and related mysterious arts were all subsumed under the name of the Hermetic arts. They were considered to be ruled by Hermes. Why was that? I can't go into the great extent, because all of these, alchemy and magic and astrology, divinations and things like that, what are these? These are really the part of the art of relationships with these powers, with these guardians. The magician can relate himself to earth, water, fire, air, and various entities, Tartarian or otherwise. This is the way of relating. This is the way of understanding what they do, how they are, how to talk to them, and then one can overcome their power with knowledge. And the same in transformation, which is the great art of alchemy. These are the ways in which the doer of the Hermetic work overcomes the world. But remember now, he doesn't practice magic just in order to be powerful and to make money and get gold and lord it over people. That's the work of the stupid lower magician who eventually always comes to an evil end. And the alchemist also doesn't do that just to make gold, but to learn the art of transformation. These are the intricacies whereby this is worked. Then came the period just prior to the Renaissance, when the Turks were pressing in on particularly the Byzantine Empire already, and a whole number of hermetic works were brought for safekeeping to Rome and to Italy from the Byzantine Empire, which were all hermetic works, and were there under the patronage, let's say, with the grants coming from the Medici family, were translated by people like Marsilio Ficino and others, and into Latin and into Italian, languages that people understood, and it was a real mind blower. And it caused, literally caused, most of the Renaissance. There are really two Renaissances. There's the so-called humanistic Renaissance and there's the hermetic Renaissance. Francis Yates was the great uncoverer of this particular historical factor. So you might say everything from the artistic Renaissance in Italy to the English Renaissance, people like Shakespeare and so forth, was deeply influenced by the hermetic revival, the hermetic Renaissance. And it's really out of that hermetic Renaissance, that in a kind of spiritual, intellectual fashion, we have been living off that practically to the present time. There isn't an awful lot left now anymore. We kind of sucked it dry, you know, but we have. And now, of course, there is a possibility of another Renaissance. And I've often felt that the Nag Hammadi findings are very much like the hermetic corpus at that time. Now again, something has become available. This is no longer hermetic, but it's Gnostic, very, very similar, and perhaps there is a synchronicity in that also. So it would seem that these two old brothers, the hermetic and the Gnostic, really Hermes and the Gnostic Christ, like the two serpents of the caduceus of Hermes, have been moving and twisting back and forth through history around the central axis of Gnosis. Around the central axis of Gnosis. And that perhaps now the other serpent, the serpent of wisdom, the old Ophios of the Gnostics, is coming into its own and supplying now what the Hermetic has supplied at the time of the Renaissance. And the story goes on. And perhaps in an interesting way we are part of that story. Of course, at the same time also the natives get restless and then as perhaps after all this time now in the confinement here we ourselves get restless. But you know, this is the age of amplification. So maybe as they amplify other things, so we need to amplify our own hermetic vision. Let me conclude with a tiny bit of a personal keynote here. Some years ago, I sort of had as Gnostics do these funny things, they got to forgive us for it, had a kind of a little momentary encounter with what I thought was Hermes. And he waved his wand over the countryside. It was on an island. He waved his wand over the countryside and everything burst into an incredible glory. I mean, the nature transfigured everything of in an absolutely fabulous aspect. And I sort of asked in my mind, why are you showing this? Is this the way things really are? Is this the way we ought to see things? And the answer came back, no. You are shown this because this is a faint reflection of the way things really are in the land where you came from and where I am. So the most beautiful, the most glorious transformation of this world is a reflection of the true glory of Hermes in his place. And this is really the delicate interaction. See what is around you. See the beauties and the intricacies and the magnificence and the power, the magic of earth, water, fire, and air, and ether. See it as the reflection, the manifestation at this coarser level of the glory and the magnificence that is pertaining to the world of Hermes, and follow the Psychopomp, follow the Poimander, the shepherd of the soul, and with his staff and with his light and with his wings, he will take you to the blessed land. He will shepherd you, he will guide you, because he is the good shepherd, whether he is called Christ Jesus or whether he is called Hermes Trismegistus. He is our friend, he is our leader, he is our wise guide. And, as the scriptures in those prayers which I read to you before, he is also within ourselves and we are in him. And perhaps we have thus seen on other, and in many ways perhaps the most closely related, the most magnificent manifestation of an other Christ, of an other great figure and inspiration of the Gnosis this time. And I thank you for having been here, and I hope you'll be with us next time.